computer. There we go.
Okay.
Thanks everybody for coming. We have Glenn Rumble with us, who most of our members are familiar with Glenn. He's a member of our board. He's our
Yes,
legal
sir.
counsel and the author of our legal guide. And we're not going to take too much of his time with his introduction. He knows who he is. So we've submitted all your questions to Glenn, and we welcome you to speak up or add more questions to the chat as we go along, and Glenn's going to do his best to take care of those.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Beth. And actually, as far as questions go, if either you or Wendy could collect those, even the ones that have been pre-submitted, and just ask me if, you know, if we have a quiet point, that would be a better way, a good way to do it.
Sure.
Okay. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm some of the faces I recognize from past broadcasts. Glad you could join us here this morning. I was trying to think how to begin this, and what I came up with is just a little bit of an overview. It always ensures we're all on the same page. So the first is, you know, getting out exactly what it is I can respond to. I'm an Ontario lawyer. This industry is regulated provincially. And this is a seminar. So I'm more than happy to respond generally to general questions, even if it's about you, generalize it if you can, because this isn't a forum in which I can really delve into the facts of your situation in detail to understand very specific problems you may have, or if you're residing in another province, I'm actually prohibited from providing legal advice, direct legal advice in another province. Things like books are general statements. One can always write on those, but I can't give, you know, if you're living in BC, for example, I can't give you advice under BC law directly, but I can speak generally, conceptually to BC laws. So let's try to keep the discussion slightly more general, a little less personal. Looking at the topic, I kind of break it down into two categories, you know, that people always ask about: what can I do and how best do I do it? So the what can I do part of the question is something hopefully you're all familiar with, so I won't take too much time on it. And that is, you know, how this industry is regulated. And that's just what I want to make sure we're all on the same page and we understand that. As I said a moment ago, it's regulated provincially, which and territorially, which means there are, you know, multiple jurisdictions in Canada. There's no national regulator for this industry, so every province and every territory has its own rules. And those rules fall into one of two baskets, depending upon where you live. One basket I call professional exclusivity. The other I call restricted activity. And the professional exclusivity means some provinces simply have laws that say, unless you're a doctor, you can't practice medicine. Unless you're a dietitian, you can't practice dietetics. Unless you're a naturopath, you can't provide naturopathic services. And that's and they don't usually provide too much detail on what constitutes medicine, naturopathy, dietetics. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But so unless you're one of those professions, you can't provide those services. The other area is called restricted activity. And some provinces, such as Ontario, BC, Alberta, Quebec, they, instead of regulating by practice professionality, they regulate by activity. So they couldn't care less what you do, but they don't want you cutting into human tissue unless you're like a medical doctor, for example, or they don't want you manipulating joints unless you're a chiropractor. So there's a long list of activities or actions involved in the human body that one can only perform if one is in one of the sanctioned professions. And usually doctors can do virtually everything. And then nurses can do a subset, naturopaths can do a subset. And in some provinces, dieticians can do a subset, very, you know, one or two items. In some provinces, they can't do any. But that's regulation by restricted activity. And the third component of what you can and can't do, I would say, would be negligence. And that would mean, you know, when you're providing your services, not only can you not, I think someone has an audio on
Next
providing.
time, eat breakfast at home.
There we go. So the third is negligence, and that is simply, you know, whatever it is that you do, you have to do it within your training. And you know, what you've learned about nutrition obviously is the area, but it comes into play like diagnoses, because many provinces restrict, you know, the ability expressly to render a diagnosis unless you're either a medical doctor or, you know, naturopath in certain areas, etc. And people would think, you know, well, I'm a nutritionist. I know about body health and nutrition. Why can't I diagnose, you know, ill health? And I think it's not because of what you know about nutrition. It's perhaps what you don't know about other causes of ill health. So, you know, you may think it's a nutritional cause, but perhaps it's hormonal, perhaps it's cancer or something else, which is why, generally speaking, nutritionists shouldn't you know, diagnose even in a province where they may technically be allowed to, because you don't have the breadth of medical knowledge, you know, to cover every aspect of causation. So that's what you can do. And then the how you do it basket has a number of things. You know, some of it I would say are hard points, and some of them are soft points. So soft points, you know, how you do it, I recommend you be part of an association. Obviously, we all are here. You've made that decision. I think it's a good one. It helps, you know, put you in touch with a network, and that helps deal with the, you know, the negligence aspect of things and how to practice. You know, I would recommend on the how you do it that you always have insurance. No one says, you know, there's no requirement at law that you have insurance. There's a requirement of this association to be a member that you have insurance to protect yourselves and protect your clients. But, you know, you should, even if you weren't a member of this association, you somehow got into this call, I would say you should still have, you know, insurance. You know, the how you do it, you should use forms and waivers. So you know, there's in my book, I have some forms and waivers you can use, but and that's to make sure the client knows exactly your, you know, what it is that you, the service that you're providing, and they're waiving, you know, certain risks with any kind of health provision of service, and that helps protect you. There is you know, specific health industry, you know, things you need to know and things that you know, that you have to do. So for example, you're all custodians, if you're in practice, of personal health information. And in the area of, you know, personal privacy, that's considered, along with financial information, among the most sensitive of personal information. So you should be complying with PIPEDA, which is the federal government, you know, privacy legislation. And in certain provinces, they also have provincial privacy, you know, regulations. So in Ontario, for example, we have the Personal Health Information Protection Act, and it sets out, you know, rules that are to be followed by people who are custodians of personal health information of individuals, you know, and in a broad brush kind of way of dealing with it. Basically, that means you have to tell people what information you collect. You have to tell them why you're collecting it. You have to tell them how you're going to use it. You have to tell them how you're going to store it. You have to store it securely so it can't be easily hacked and accessed by people who are not authorized to see it. You have to let people see what you have on them if they ask. Makes all kinds of sense. And you know, once you no longer need it and for any purpose, you're supposed to destroy it. Those are kind of the big broad brush principles of privacy. And all of this is supposed to be written up in a privacy policy that you can make available to people. But that's kind of the big spectrum on privacy, but you need to make sure you're, you know, you're complying with privacy rules. Another kind of how do you do it general point I would make is, you know, you want to practice in conjunction with registered professionals, obviously medical doctors, naturopaths, you know, and others that are within the industries. So if you suspect an ailment or a problem with an individual, you should tell them to seek, you know, advice of their medical professional, be it a medical doctor, a naturopath, or whatever, you know, whoever it is, that they seek to. I wouldn't diagnose it yourself, and then you know, you document that you've done that because you want to practice in conjunction with other professions, not displace other professions. Because by and large, you know, we are not part. I am a lawyer, but we are not, as a nutritionist community, a regulated profession in any province, which means we're regulated by what we can't do. There's no one telling us really what we can do. There's just a bunch of rules of that confine us rather than empower us. And then the final area of, you know, how you do what you do, is actually the main thrust of my practice in life, my legal practice, which is business law. And this is just, you know, the general points of running a successful and profitable business, because at the end of the day, if you're in private practice, it's obviously a business as much as it is a service to help people. And you know, you deal with questions about, you know, should you incorporate, do you need to incorporate, when to incorporate, you know, branding issues, understanding trademark and trademarking, And how you protect your brand if you've come up with a great name for your business or your clinic or whatever you're practicing. And these are all points I can speak to, because what I'm hoping is when I finish this very short overview, we'll get more into a Socratic kind of dialogue. You'll be asking me questions, and that will prompt more questions. It will be more interesting for everybody. The other thing, business choices is use of the internet to deliver services. That's always a question mark for people on how one does that and what rules one follows. There is the question of selling third-party products, because many people in this business, part of what they do is they sell natural health products or sometimes diagnostic services. And the question is, can you, edit from a business law perspective and regulatory perspective, can you do that? How do you do that? What are you bound by? Then there's, if you're business with other people, there's kind of relationships with employees and business partners and others. And I can speak to all of that. So that's kind of the broad brush spectrum of the area, dealing with, as I said,
Glenn, you're muted.
Your audio went off, Glenn.
All right. Hopefully it didn't mute after I said, hi, I'm Glenn.
No.
Okay. I didn't even touch anything. That's weird. Okay. So whereabouts, how long was I muted for?
Just a minute.
Yeah. You're just finished saying relationships with business partners and that. And
oh, okay. So that was actually my final point. So, when you're running a business, I won't go into taxation. I'm not a tax lawyer, but as I said, there's incorporating and there's branding and there's how you deliver your services through the internet or otherwise. There's selling third-party products. And there's also, working with people, be it employees or business partners or clinics and some of the, the rules and rights and wrongs around that. And I'm more than happy to speak to any topics that I've raised or if I've, missed something that's important to you, that topic as well. So think of this as roughly 45 minutes with a relatively, unfortunately, gray-haired, experienced lawyer who can hopefully provide some guidance to you and, in next steps of what you should be considering. And let's open the floor.
So I guess for starters, does anybody who's here have a question they'd like to ask directly?
I have a question.
Sure.
I'm wondering about if writing ebooks and or like self-paced programs or webinars that you sell kind of as a package, is the disclaimer written on the book itself enough, or do you have to buy some type of separate like insurance for it to be you be protected, I guess?
No, I think in the area of writing, and by protected you're meaning for making a mistake in what you're advising people, or if someone follows what you're recommending and they have ill health, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, I guess just so you don't get sued or something.
Yeah. The publishing industry is a pretty forgiving one, because you can, if you go into any wellness sector area of any bookstore, you'll find everything from, witchcraft, to science and everything in between. So if you're not directing your comments specifically at an individual, then you're usually in pretty good shape in a book. You need insurance. I think, just an author's biography, about yourself and your perspective on the advice that you're giving would be an important thing to include, so they understand your perspective and skill level. The one thing you do not want to do is have people thinking you're a medical doctor. So if you're very, very technical in what you do and they think that you may be a medical professional, in many provinces, holding yourself out to be a doctor is actually a breach of medical acts and other kinds of statutes. So you want to avoid that. And obviously, you want to ensure that the best that you can, that what you're writing is accurate, to the extent it's represented as science, that it is science, and to the extent it's opinion, that it's represented as opinion.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah, and you had mentioned before talking about like waivers and things for clients to sign when you're signing them on. Do you have examples of? I've like pulled examples from the internet, but it would be nice to know that I have an example from like a lawyer.
Yeah.
Is there examples that are available?
I do have it in the back of the book that the CNMP publishes. So if you don't know, years ago, I wrote this guide, and every couple of years, I update it. I think it was updated in 2022, so it's relatively current right now. And it does contain some standard forms in there, intake forms and waivers and releases that you can use. You have to watch. I'm glad you said you download from the internet, but you're asking a question. One does have to watch what they offload from the internet, because you don't know the knowledge base of the person who wrote it or the specific regulations they may be taking into account when they did write it. So whenever someone's giving you advice on the internet, you have to know where that advice is coming from. If it's coming from California, the UK, Germany, Canada, it's very relevant to know, because there's a regulatory regime around what they might be saying. So I would say, is it Francis?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, you can order the book from the CNMP, and they will put, and it does have, precedence in it.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Glenn, on that subject, what about for podcasts and webinars? I've heard people who give podcasts and webinars then afterwards say, now the legal notes, Is there anything different there?
I don't, it really depends on what you're saying, because as I said, if you keep your comments general, and if you're coming from an opinion-based perspective, for example, it's very hard to get into trouble. I mean, one only needs to watch politics in the United States and some of the crazy lying that goes on to understand that, podcasts and broadcasts and in written language, people get away with murder with what they're saying when it's in the realm of opinion. You just have to be a bit more careful when you're talking about scientific fact, and you're holding it out to be a fact, and someone maybe relies on that fact to their detriment. But I don't think there's anything special needed for podcasts, no, generally speaking.
Iman, you raised your hand. Hi, Iman.
Hi. Thank you for being here. This is really informative. So just by extension to what I think was Francis and Beth were saying, so yes. In terms of online courses that we may want to produce, or group courses or classes, same kind of umbrella that you're talking about, like keep it general, or like if we're having a specific course on a specific health condition, like is that a no-no?
No, you can do that. It boils down to providing advice in a situation in which it's reasonable to expect the person to rely upon your advice in their life. So if you're conducting that seminar and someone says to you, I have a health condition, and they describe it to you and say, what should I be doing? And you say, well, if I was you, I would be taking this supplement, and I would, I wouldn't be taking that medicine, and you're getting into a lot of problems. But if someone says, someone has, what do you recommend for someone with, low blood sugar, diabetes, iron deficiencies, or something like that, and you're talking in the abstract, I think you're in a much safer place. And I always, the easy fix for everyone in this industry is to always supplement your advice. If you're providing specific advice with, you should obviously consult with a medical doctor, because there may be non-nutritional factors contributing to the situation, and always guide them in that direction. But just because you're conducting a seminar doesn't mean, it's a very high bar to run into negligence when you're conducting a seminar about beliefs and opinions, and in a very general way.
Right.
Just keep it fact-based. Like if you're going to say something solid, make sure, like if you're doing a PowerPoint or something, that you've got your references and stuff like that, just to cover yourself.
Yeah. And, on the waiver side, I said that you don't need anything special. I'm going to qualify that, because just don't, when you say keep it fact-based, again, I think I would always tell people that if they have any specific concerns about their own situation, they should consult with their medical professional. Having a kind of waiver or notice that says, okay, this is general information. This is not meant to be treating any individual specific situation or person. If you have this, take the knowledge you've gained here and then go and speak to a qualified professional. And if you, and that may be another, that may be you as a nutritionist in a one-on-one where you can really delve into their situation. It may be a medical professional or someone else, but I think I would definitely have that kind of a, you know, rider around it, you know, especially in a PowerPoint presentation. I do that in my PowerPoint presentations about law. If I was had one right now, you would see there would be a little bit of a waiver there, just letting you know this is general discussion. This is not for specific applications.
Great, thank you.
But there is nothing wrong with opinion either in all of this, right? I just think you need to be mindful about when you're quoting fact and when you're quoting opinion, if someone's going to be relying upon it. Opinion obviously is a more subjective thing than is fact. And that's why you want to make sure you're mindful about which one you're conveying.
Thank you.
Alice has her hand up.
Hi.
Hi, good morning, Alice.
So I began my practice in Ontario. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to BC. Mm-hmm. And now in a clinic, seeing people one-on-one, but also mm-hmm. continuing to see clients in Ontario that I've had. And mm-hmm. then I've been on some podcasts, and that is attracting people from the US to mm-hmm. want to consult with me. And I'm just not sure, like, do I just stick to, like, is there anything that I should now be changing in terms of my practice, because now I'm living in BC, and also if I'm seeing people outside of BC?
Yeah, I think what you need to keep in mind is that all the regulation of this industry is around consumer protection. All the governments, mm-hmm. every government, you know, United States, Canada, all the provinces, they want to make sure that their citizens are getting information from professionals who they deem qualified to provide that information. And that means that every province and every state, every country can have different rules around that. So just because something was legal and permissible in Ontario, once you're dealing with a client in BC or the United States, doesn't mean that it's legal or permissible in those jurisdictions. So you always have to ensure that you're complying with the laws of the jurisdiction in which your client resides. And if you don't know what those laws are, then I would say you shouldn't deal with clients in that area until you inquire and find out what they are and make sure what you're doing is lawful. So to give you a practical example, in Ontario, the restricted activities list that I mentioned prohibits you from from diagnosing diseases and disorders, but it doesn't restrict you from treating diseases and disorders. So that's permissible. So if someone comes to you and say, you know, I've been diagnosed with X, can you help me out nutritionally? You can say, yes, you can treat that disease or disorder. In other provinces or other countries, that may not be permitted. You may not be able
to
treat a specific
disease.
Let me just check. I actually prepared a handy little table to refresh my memory on these things.
I think generally, Glenn, the Ontario and BC are quite liberal.
Yeah.
My experience. And then it's the East Coast and Quebec, which tend to have a different model and be a little bit more restrictive.
That's right. Alberta's wide open. They don't restrict diagnosing or treating. Keeping in mind that none of this can be negligent, because no matter what the law requires, if you don't have the knowledge base and the skill level to provide it and you cause harm, someone may sue you for negligence. So that's a whole nother thing. I would have to inquire. I'd have to really dig in to answer that specifically about BC. But the point is you need to know the rules around, you know, where the person is that you're living. So if you're moving from Ontario where you can treat a diagnosed disease and you move to, Saskatchewan, where they don't regulate by restricted activity, they regulate by professional exclusivity. So what they say is, unless you're a licensed medical professional, you can't provide medical services. And then very conveniently, they don't define what medical services mean. So one is left, you know, what does that mean? And then you have to look, you know, this is what in my book is about in part, you look at court decisions and other kind of things to try to flesh it out. So my advice to you, Alice, would be, you know, since you're living in BC and working in a clinic, hopefully you already know what you can and can't do in BC. If you're treating clients in Ontario, you know, you came from that jurisdiction, hopefully you know those two. But if you take on another jurisdiction, such as the United States, you have to know the rules of the state in which the individual resides to do it lawfully. The other two elements of this I'm going to point out with real real caution around it. So is you also have to keep in mind about what the chances of causing harm are, because generally speaking, this industry is enforced reactively, meaning you cause someone physical harm, they then either sue you or complain, and then police or someone else might look into it, you know, or you may get involved with the law in that way. So if you're causing no harm whatsoever, even if you're breaching the laws, it's a little bit like speeding on the 401 at 2 o'clock in the morning, right? You're doing 120 and you're speeding, but no one's going to catch you. And that's why a lot of people say, well, I know someone who's doing this and they've had no problem. And the answer is probably you're correct, because they're not causing any harm. Doesn't mean it's lawful, but it does mean that they are unlikely to attract the authorities if they're not causing any harm and there's a low risk of them causing harm. And that's why people get away with it for a long period of time, or maybe their whole careers and never have a hiccup, because, you know, every case they're doing, they're speeding on the 401, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning and there's no one there.
I think that that's right, and that there's very few cases of practitioners being charged. I think you mentioned in your research, Glenn, across Canada, what's more likely to happen is you'll get a letter from the Dietitians of Canada saying that you're overstepping your bounds, perhaps in the title that you call yourself or the impression that you're giving that you may be part of the dietitians or whatever. And they're very protective of their particular rights. So that's more likely to be the case, I would say, from what I've heard.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. Actually, when I was first researching the book, I spoke with a fellow in Saskatchewan. Can't recall if it was the medical college or the OPP, because I talked to OPP, RCMP, you know, medical colleges, different places. And he said, for example, in Saskatchewan, they used to have a very, they were very aggressive in enforcing the laws. And then what they found was that people wanted alternative health services. They were very protective of their health service provider. And that they couldn't get any support when they were trying to shut someone down who they thought may be moving into the area of medicine. So what they decided to do in Saskatchewan at that time, they said, is they were going to only enforce complaints and harm. So if someone came to them and said, you know what, I went to so-and-so and, you know, I had cancer and they told me to, I don't know, do a coffee enema. I've heard that story in the internet. You can go down to Mexico and get coffee enemas for cancer. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, they prescribed that for me. And now I'm going to die. That's something that they would say, okay, hang on a second. You shouldn't have done that. But they're not going to enforce against someone who's basically saying, you know, okay, you're obese. Let's clean up your diet and get you on a better, more nutrient-dense diet, you know, get cut out the sugars and the fats. No one's going to prosecute you for that. Because it's just not worth their while to, even if they thought within their jurisdiction that might be delving into treating a disease or disorder, because obesity is a disease or disorder, right? And you're not supposed to do that in certain provinces, but they're not going to shut you down for doing it. So there is the, what strictly can you do? And, you know, my legal advice to you is always stay within what you can do, but, you know, there's a fuzzy zone in enforcement where, you know, people tend not to get into trouble unless they're causing harm. And I would be negligent if I didn't point that out to you.
Okay.
I have a follow-up question about BC. So in BC, if you belong to a certain college, the tax rules change depending on how you're defined. So like, for example, chiropractors don't have to charge PSC, whereas RMTs do. Do you know about the legal definition of a nutritionist that would dictate where, like, if we have to charge PSD or not?
Yeah. No, the short answer would be I don't know anything about BC tax law and provincial tax codes in BC. I can't be of any help there at all.
Okay.
Daniela, you have your hand up, and then we'll go
first. Thank you. Thank you so much, Glenn, for this. This is very, very useful. One quick one about supplements. This is always sort of like there are the, you know, some very established supplements say, oh, it's winter time, vitamin D, whatever, vitamin B12 if you're over 50. So these are kind of very established, well-known mm-hmm. things. However, there are many supplements, and I tend to stick to just sort of food pretty much, except for these well-established supplements. But there are some supplements that, you know, supplements are not really that regulated. Some can be from, so if you say to someone, yeah, you know, you're not sleeping well, take some melatonin. This has been a very big conversation about melatonin having various concentrations mm-hmm. of actual product. So you can say to someone, take 5 milligrams, they end up, you know, taking 50 because the supplement was not well mm-hmm. put together kind of thing. So that, I feel like that's a very sort of, again, fuzzy zone that can come back and say, well, you said I should take that. And then, I don't know, I was just, I did this, I bumped into something, or I had an accident, or, you know, so.
Yeah, I think though, in that example, Danielle, you'd look at negligence. Mm-hmm. And you would say, in recommending melatonin for someone who, you know, wants to improve their sleep. And you'll notice mm-hmm. how I phrase things. I always try to phrase things in the context of improving their health and vitality rather than treating a disorder. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. I think the safest position for everybody in the nutrition community, regardless of your regulation, is to, you know, we help improve your immune system, improve your health and vitality, rather than, you know, I will treat you if you have X, Y, or Z. So with melatonin, you know, is it negligent to say to someone who wants to have a sounder night's sleep that melatonin is known for improving, you know, sleep? No, I would say you're not negligent. Now, if they buy melatonin and instead of a 5 milligram capsule, the manufacturer has put 500 milligrams into that capsule, that's a manufacturer negligence. You're not responsible for the manufacturer's right. negligence on that. So does that help?
Yeah, no, that helps a lot. It's like, you know, like I said, mostly you obviously want to stick to food and, you know, making very sure that you're improving, yeah. never treating.
But I think you can fairly safely recommend natural health products to people.
Yeah.
It's what the government is really concerned about with let's just take a minute and go into natural health products for a second. The government's concerned with two things with natural health products, by and large. They're concerned with how they're made. So the manufacturing environment. And, you know, we're putting it in our bodies and we're eating it and digesting it. So I think we all want to make sure that it's in a clean manufacturing environment and doesn't contain contaminants. That makes perfect sense. The other thing the government's concerned about with natural health products is what is said about them. And if you're telling someone that melatonin will assist in their sleep, that's a pretty safe statement. If you're recommending a natural health product because it will cure something, that's where the government starts to have a bit more problem. And that's where the whole natural health product, it's in the labeling. So if they have, you know, chamomile, you know, historically used to, you know, to relax the body and sleep well at night, no one's going to have a problem with that. But if they say, you know, chamomile, it will, I don't know enough about it, but I'll say cure post-nasal drip. I have no idea, right? You know, that, and they put that on the box. The government would want to see some kind of evidence that actually that's what that natural health product will do, because they want to protect consumers from sham remedies a little bit. And, you know, one can argue whether they get too strong-armed or that or not, but that's the underlying rationale with it. So I think right. you can more or less safely recommend natural health products to people. You don't have to only stick to food. Mm-hmm. If it's your own self-manufactured natural health product, then you've got a whole nother, you know,
right
issues that you need to look at.
Okay, no, thank you, that was very useful.
I would just say also, Danielle, you want to learn about the different manufacturers, and so
absolutely,
you know, you want to recommend one that's not going to put 500 in when you're looking at, you know, 5.
Right. So that was a bit of an extreme example, but, you know, just because there's such a wide variety of things. On if you want to add, say, fitness certification to the nutritionist certification, then you need extra insurance, even if you just do it just online, conveying the information online, say through like video instructions or whatever. Do you still need insurance for that, or would?
Well, keep in mind, so two points to that. The first is, I do not know about insurance. I think Beth and Wendy are probably more knowledgeable about the scope of insurance policies within your industry than I am. So mm-hmm. I can't speak to that. But when you say, do you need insurance at law? No one needs insurance to provide nutritional counseling services, sports related, you know, coaching. There's no insurance required at law. It's a prudent thing that one does to protect your own personal assets, your family. The CNAP recommends it, or requires it, I guess, for all members for two reasons. One is to help you protect yourself. And the other is just in case there's injury, you know, the client would have access to a pool of capital to help them in their life, you know, if they've got some kind of recovery. So it's both good for clients and the practitioner, which is why we require it. But at law, there's no requirement that you have insurance in order to provide, because you are not a regulated entity. I, as a lawyer, must have insurance to be a member of the Law Society of Ontario and provide legal services. Medical doctors must have insurance to be medical doctors. You don't have that same kind of regulation anywhere in Canada.
I see. Thank you. That's very clear.
It's not mandatory.
Yeah. We also like members to carry insurance, so that when we do our campaign to insurance companies for our clients, that we can go to them and say that, you know, we conduct ourselves professionally. We're sort of, in lieu of being like a regulated profession, we kind of have a standards that when we go to insurance companies and say, you can be comfortable that our practitioners are operating within scope of practice, they carry insurance, et cetera. We like to be able to say that across.
Absolutely. The board. It adds a lot of credibility to the industry, and it's useful in other ways too. Like, just, you know, last year we had a big win in Nova Scotia, where Nova Scotia was passing new legislation. Well, they started in 2009, so I shouldn't call it too new, 14 years old, but they were passing legislation which would pretty well shut down the nutritional consulting industry in Nova Scotia, unless you were a licensed dietitian. And, you know, as an organization, we took that up as a cause. And last year we were told that they're changing the regulations to carve out for people like nutritionists, that they can provide nutritional counseling services in the province, even though they're not licensed dietitians. Can't call yourself a dietitian, but you can provide the service. And part of the argument we made is the very one that Wendy just made. You know, we require members to have insurance. We recommend it. We're a mature industry. We act prudently. And they took that all into account.
No, that makes total sense. I know. I'm kind of armed to the gills with insurance. So it's all good. Thank you so much.
You can go through BrokerLink if you're insured through BrokerLink, and CNAP has been working with BrokerLink for many years. They have all these modality add-ons. So you can insure yourself as a nutritionist and have your basic coverage, and then you can add other modalities. So you might want to look at that if you're looking to add fitness into it. It's usually a nominal fee just to add on for whatever else you want to be doing.
We have two more online questions. Rochelle had her hand up.
Yes. Oh, thank you. Thanks for doing this, Glenn and Beth and Wendy. I am in Saskatchewan. So I've read your book. I have it. And I agree with what you said. There's no definition for the medical, like, what is the medical term? So your top two things in Saskatchewan that I should not do and completely stay away from that might be different from the other provinces.
Well, I would say it's what I've already said. It's diagnosing and treating specific diseases and disorders. You know, obviously, one, you can't prescribe medicines anyway, those are the two big activities, because you're trained in nutrition. So I would focus your practice on, you know, improving overall health. Like, for example, if someone has cancer and they come to you and they say, look, I have cancer and I want your help. What I would do is say, I can help improve your immune system. I can help you maximize the vibrant, you know, the health of your body as a cancer patient. But I can't treat your cancer, right? And there's a subtle but a very important difference in what you're telling the person that you can do. You can make them the healthiest cancer patient they can possibly be while they're chemotherapy or their radiation or whatever, or nothing if they're wanting to deal with it holistically, is dealing with their cancer. But I would shy away from saying, you know, I'll help treat your cancer.
Perfect. Okay, that makes total sense. A question on the privacy policy. Is there a contact management system that, and Beth and Wendy, you might be able to answer this, that is recommended for holistic nutritionists, like the Jane app, or I have another one that I use. Like, is that sufficient? Is there something special we should be using, or?
In what, I'm sorry, in what way? What kind of
like,
program?
To keep track of our clients' information and things like that, or even phone numbers and email addresses and that type of thing.
I'll let Wendy and Beth answer that, the specific question about the tool. But the general principle, though, is one of security. So right now I'm on my laptop and I have all my legal clients' personal information, you know, online, in the cloud, on the laptop. So, you know, obviously everything is password protected. I use certain grade of programs that lawyers use, that, you know, Microsoft systems for in the cloud, which has protection around it.
Right.
And as long as you're using industry standard means of ensuring protection and being prudent about it, you'll be fine with the security of the information. If you maintain paper records and you're in a public clinic, it should be in a locked filing cabinet behind a locked door kind of thing. It, you know, it shouldn't just be just sitting out where anyone can happen across it. So it's just kind of prudent means of security. That's on the security side. That's what the most laws require in the privacy area, as well as notice to people, et cetera. Now I'll leave it to Wendy and Beth to tell you if there's a tool that they're aware of.
Thank you.
Yeah. I wouldn't say necessarily there's a particular tool. I think JNAP is something that is very commonly used, and it's used with naturopaths, and so they would be very aware of the standards. I think what Glenn might also want to comment on this is when you're seeing people virtually, seeing clients virtually, I think making them aware, and also so if you're doing one of these online apps, make them aware that, you know, you can't necessarily vouch for the privacy within a Zoom call or with an online application. Are you comfortable doing this? You know, let the client be aware that there may be a potential for risk that you can't be accountable for. You're doing best practices, mm-hmm. but, you know, there's always that little margin when anything is online.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point, Wendy. Yeah, if you're dealing online, consulting is to let them know that you can't guarantee it's secure.
Right.
Although you use third-party products such as Zoom, for example,
which
is obviously created to try to maintain a relatively secure environment like this.
Again, Rochelle, in our back issues of The Voice, I think there's two or three articles on Zoom over COVID that we did. I think Glenn did one. I think Paul did one, which might be helpful if you could go back and find those.
I will. Thank you.
We have one more question from Hector. Nice to see you, Hector.
Good morning, Hector.
Let me unmute here myself. Yes. Hi, Beth. Hi, Wendy. Hi, everybody.
How are
Glenn,
you?
Thank you very much for all the information you have provided. It's been very, very good. Just briefly, if you can explain or you can give me your advice. What would be some of the most common things that a client could sue a nutritional consultant for?
Okay, you said two questions. What's the second one?
The second one is just kind of having a dispensary in your practice, like having your supplements in your practice. I mean, some of the supplements that you're going to be recommending in your practice, just to have it on hand for customers. I mean, not to push them, obviously, to buy them, but just to say, hey, you know, I have them here if you want it. If not, you are welcome to go and buy it anywhere else. But it's just having a dispensary in your practice.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the most common things that a client could sue a practitioner for, keeping in mind that to sue, you have to have experienced harm. Well, to sue for damages, to make it lucrative. So if you haven't harmed anyone, then obviously there is nothing to sue over. They can't show that they've had any damages or being harmed by you. Could they sue for, say they used your services for a period of time and had no positive results? Could they sue for their fee, saying you didn't do your job? I'd say that'd be an incredibly high bar. They'd never get past it. So I think it really just boils down, Hector, to negligence and making sure that the services you provide and advice you provide is, you know, at a level which someone with nutritional training should be able to provide. When I looked at the case law where people got into problems, it really was the outliers. So I, you know, there's one case that I talk about in the book where it wasn't a nutritional counselor, it was an alternative wellness provider. and they told someone with lung cancer to cease, you know, their chemotherapy or radiation, whatever they're getting, and use a peroxide regime where they were ingesting liquid peroxide, and that would cure their cancer. And that person ended up dying, and then their estate sued that advisor. And, you know, that's obviously negligence. I mean, one, you would never tell someone to stop taking their prescribed medicines. And no. Two, that's pretty out there. I don't think many people would say orally consuming peroxide will assist in curing a cancer. So there are relatively, actually almost no lawsuits in this area, because nutritionists tend not to cause harm because you're improving diets. That was one of the when I was looking at my book, the most interesting thing. When I first went into this area, I had read lots of anecdotes about how, nutritionists were, dietitians wanted them shut down and people were suing them. And it almost seemed like a profession that was under attack. So I do what lawyers do. I went to the case law and I said, okay, I'm going to search nutritionist and I'll see what cases come up and see how they're being sued. And it was like, nothing. What else are they called? Dietitians? Nothing. Food counselors? Nothing. And I kept all these keyword searches. And then I came across one like the one I said, and then there's other ways you can get into it. But they were all people on the extreme, because normal nutritional counseling just doesn't cause harm. So if you're not being negligent and recommending crazy things, and you're not impersonating a doctor and doing, you know, I think you're absolutely fine. And I can't say that there is a common, you know, cause for being sued as a nutritionist. As far as selling supplements in your practice, there's nothing wrong with that. If you can get a wholesaling on supplements and you can mark them up and make some money retailing supplements, you're just a retail distributor of supplements, and it's the supplement company that's responsible for the content of the supplements. Your only exposure might be a conflict of interest, to the extent that I'm recommending this brand of supplements because I sell them, and you know, maybe that breaches your objectivity. But what's the harm? A $12 bottle of supplements versus a $9 bottle of supplements or a $15? It's nothing anyone's going to sue over. So, stick to brand name natural health products. Feel free to retail them as long as you comply with any, you know, retail sales requirements within your province to sell these products. And I wouldn't have any concerns about it.
Great. We have two more.
Thank you. Thanks, Len.
Yeah, you're welcome, Hector.
Natasha?
Sorry, I wasn't quick on the unmute. Okay, so I have a couple things now from hearing people talk. I'll try and make it brief. I just want to say, from working, I've worked in supplements now for almost 6 years in retail, including management, and you get to know the brands really well. And in Canada here, I mean, nothing can be on the shelf unless it's approved by Health Canada. So there's quite a bit of rigorous mm-hmm. testing and regulations. And some of the professional companies actually operate almost like on the standard of a pharmaceutical company. So they're quite good products that are on the shelves. I would say when you are ordering from the States, that's where it starts to get a little sketchy. You don't necessarily know what's in them. And this is just going back to, I wasn't sure what her name was, like somebody taking melatonin and it being too much. Because my other thought there is, if they're taking it and they're feeling groggy and they're bumping into things, well, there's other things to explore there. Either the dose is too high or the person doesn't need it, because melatonin's not for everybody.
Can I interject for just one moment? I would say you shouldn't be selling natural health products sourced outside of Canada unless they're licensed in Canada. So that, you know, you mentioned that point. If you're reselling a product out of the US, if you are importing a product, make sure it's legal to be sold in Canada.
Right. And I'm just saying here, like if you go to a health food store here, mm-hmm. Okay, not all of them are Canadian. That's true. I mean, but
they would all need a natural health product license to be in retail. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a gray area too. So
yeah. Fair enough.
Just because, like personally where I work, we sell Physica and Physica doesn't have an NPN. So it's a bit of an issue right now with everything that's going on with C-47, Bill okay. C-47. And my question is around C-47 and how and if it does impact us right now as in private practice. Because we've talked about that at the store level and how that kind of does change how we talk with customers. But my understanding is it doesn't really affect us too much in the private setting. I mean, it's more around NHPs, not nutrition per se.
Yeah, I won't proclaim to be an expert in that, Bill. Wendy and Beth, maybe you can direct anyone to the people within our industry who are really monitoring that legislation. My understanding is, though, it's really doing, it has one main function, and that is to add natural health products to a, what would I call it? I'll call it a feedback loop. So pharmaceuticals, if a pharmaceutical causes a material adverse health effect, hospitals are obligated by law to report that to Health Canada, and then Health Canada can investigate whether or not that pharmaceutical, that prescription drug, whatever, has a problem. And natural health products were excluded from that when that law came in. I think it's called Vanessa's Law is the colloquialism for it. So the main thrust of the legislation is to add natural health products to it. So the idea is if a hospital becomes aware of a material adverse effect caused by a natural health product, then they're obligated to report that product to Health Canada so Health Canada can investigate. In and of itself, to me, that sounds actually like a good thing. What's coming along with that, though, is some increased fees and regulations around natural health products to implement that. Because let's face it, our governments are running deficits and they have for years. They don't want to increase, you know, their obligations without raising revenue. So they're going to be charging some fees to natural health product manufacturers, you know, increased licensing fees and other kinds of fees to create the budget in which they can now provide this feedback loop or service. So I don't see how that would impact your function with natural health products if someone recommending them. And I don't think as a practitioner, although I can't swear to this, so I don't think you're caught in the reporting loop. I think it's hospitals and those kind of organizations. But Wendy and Beth might be able to, you know, provide you a link to whoever in our industry is, you know, at the tip of the iceberg watching this stuff.
Okay. I think the concern would be, like, if you use a lot of supplements in your practice, for example, or you're using very specific ones, mm-hmm. that long term, it's kind of like, what's the outlook for being a nutritionist? If these are things that you're normally using, and because we don't know what's going to go off the shelves. But the idea is that there's going to be a lot less available. And I know there's a repeal process mm-hmm. right now, and there's a lot of stuff going on. So it's really hard to say what it looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, again, I'll defer to whoever Beth and Wendy recommend you to, because I don't follow the natural health product sector, you know,
okay.
with day-to-day rigor. But I would say that generally speaking, our governments don't like to shut down businesses. And let's face it, natural health product manufacturers, nutritionists, we're all part of the consumers and we're all voters. I don't think they're going to wantonly shut down the industry. I personally don't believe in pharmaceutical conspiracies. I do think that there can be overregulation in areas, and those overregulations can eventually have negative and adverse effects. So I won't say that won't happen. But I don't think you're going to see a whole scale like reduction in products available in the marketplace. I personally have been hearing that for 20 years. Every time another regulatory, you know, rule comes in, everyone said natural health products are all going to be pulled. We can't recommend them. We're all going to be nothing left but pharmaceutical. That never seems to happen. But that doesn't mean that there aren't competitive problems caused by overregulation. And I can't say it won't happen, but.
Glenn, can we close on you for a few more minutes? We have two more questions and we won't take any more.
Okay, sure.
Okay, Melissa?
Hi, thank you so much for your time today. And mine's just a quick one. If anyone knows anything about the legalities in Manitoba.
Sorry, Melissa, your audio went out there. The legalities in Manitoba and then you cut out.
Yeah. Yeah, just like restrictions, if there are any for practicing, if I am located in Ontario or if I happen to move there.
I would say the place to start would be to take a look at my book, which does set out the regulations in each of the provinces. And if it's a topic that you're concerned with, it's not covered by the book, consult a Manitoba lawyer would be my advice to, or an Ontario lawyer, depending on which province you're shifting into.
Okay, because I think it was up for changing, and I was wondering if anyone had known if there was any change that did happen. But thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's take a question from Jill, and then we'll do a quick run through. There's not very many chat questions. Many of them have been answered. So, Jill?
Hi there. Okay, quick question. I know that we're not allowed to do any testing when it comes to, say, food sensitivity or food intolerance testing. However, I was wondering whether or not there was another way around it, that essentially I was considering offering it as a promotion, that if people signed up this month, that they would receive a free food intolerance testing kit. And so that would then be sent directly to them. Like they would, I guess there's two ways. They would probably have to order it themselves. They would have to do the test, obviously, themselves, and they would have to receive the results and interpret them themselves. I wouldn't be able to interpret them. Is that available to me? Or is there any things I should be cautious of?
Okay. Where are you, Jill, where are you?
Pardon me?
What province are you in?
Oh, BC.
BC. I was going to say, the first thing is you have to look at the specific laws of where you're located, but this is a good example of how to analyze this kind of a situation. So the question is not whether or not you can recommend a test that's otherwise lawfully available in BC. So if there's someone providing a test in BC and it's lawfully available, that's their obligation to comply with BC law and make sure that they can provide the test, et cetera. If you're just saying if you recommend to someone to take a lawful test, that's now in the hands of the tester. The next question is, how do you use the results of the test? And that's what you have to make sure is lawful. So for example, if it's a test that comes back with just a whole bunch of, blood levels, et cetera, that you then have to interpret, then you have to make sure under the laws of the province in which you're practicing that you're allowed to interpret it. And then I would say within your skill set that you can interpret it without being negligent. So you got the lawful standard, then also you don't want to be negligent in what you're doing. And if you have a yes to both of those, then you can lawfully recommend the test and lawfully interpret the test. If you're in a province, though, where you are not supposed to, diagnose, you're not supposed to, let's face it, blood test would be diagnosing, and the test comes back with the diagnosed results, then you're not in any different position than a client coming to you and say, my doctor has told me I have X, can you help me with that? And then you go back to my point is, I can't treat it specifically, but what I'll do is I'll make you the healthiest person possible. We'll work on your immune system. We'll work on your vibrancy. We'll work on everything around that. And maybe that will help clear it up while you deal with your doctor. So it's really a question of what the results coming back are and how you are using them and whether you can lawfully use them in that way within your jurisdiction.
Okay. Because I had understood, and I think there's been, on Facebook groups for registered holistic nutritionists, there's been a lot of different information that people have been providing about it. And I think that's where it's become like, what's actually the facts on what we're allowed to do? From what I understood, we weren't allowed to test and we weren't allowed to interpret. But for instance, I'm specializing in digestion and gut health. And so I wanted to add this promotion of being able to do this gut health test or a food sensitivity test that I think would be valuable to them. But I'm like trying to skirt around, obviously. Right.
Yeah. And a lot of it depends on what the test is. So for example, if it's, say it's a blood test, mm-hmm. Any province with restricted activities would say that you're not allowed to, put a needle and draw blood from someone's body. So you can't administer that test. But if that tester has a facility where the blood is drawn or a saliva sample taken or whatever, and then they provide the results to you, that's a very, very different circumstance.
Okay.
So you kind
of
have to look at, what you can and can't do. Is the test legal in my area? Is it resulting in my diagnosing? Is it resulting in my treating? And then you have to work with that within the framework of your regulation. So it's kind of a diagnostic that you have to do on the situation.
Okay. I guess then the next question is like, is there anybody within
my like who do I contact in my province that could confirm that? Because for instance, like these would be tests that are, it's like an at-home kit that is sent to them. They do the analysis, like a stool analysis, and then they send it back to the lab, and the lab then emails them a PDF of their details.
I think if you were to say to a client that there's a test that's available in BC, I understand is available in BC. Here's the link to the website. You can look at it, and you know they will provide you with some information. That's fine. But if you were to
and
say,
even though I
this
was
test is lawful and you can do it, and this is, you know, and you start, then you're going down a different path.
I guess it was just that I was going to pay for it because it was like a bonus that I was offering them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's where I wonder if it got.
Yeah. I would have, you'd have to look at the laws of BC specifically.
Okay. Thank you so much.
One suggestion, Jill, is to ask your school.
Okay.
Do you have a teacher or an administrator at the school and ask them about
close the one here.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the real fail safe is to go to a lawyer. But one of the challenges in this industry is, you know, there aren't a lot of lawyers that know the rules and regs around it. So it ends up being a more costly consult because the lawyer has to research, and that always costs a bit more. But that is why we have lawyers. So if you were to have that problem and you wanted to have a definitive answer that you can rely upon, you'd go to a lawyer who's willing to look into it for you and give you advice on it. And then you could rely on that, because if that advice is wrong, that lawyer's no negligent. And if you're sued, you sue him, and you have this nice multidimensional lawsuit.
Talk about
hopefully the advice wouldn't be wrong. Hopefully he or she would do her job.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I think Wendy's going to review a couple of the chat questions, and then we won't take any more of your time.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that we've covered a lot of the chat questions. There is a question around charging HST or GST on services. I think the common understanding is if you're earning under $30,000, then you don't have to charge tax. That's been my understanding, just from what I know of the industry. I don't know if that's something you know about, Glenn.
Yes, no, I do. So you got to keep in mind there are basically three interrelated taxes you're talking about. There's GST, which is the federal tax. There's PST, which is provincial tax. And then there's HST, which is harmonized provincial federal tax. And so Ontario, for example, has the harmonized tax, the HST. The $30,000 that you're talking about, Wendy, is a GST rule. That's the federal tax, goods and services tax. And if you have, if your fees or revenues are under $30,000 per year, you do not have to charge, GST. And because Ontario is harmonized with it, you don't have to charge HST. If you're in a province that doesn't have, that isn't harmonized, and you have separate GST and PST, I would say $30,000 on the GST side, you'll have to look if there's a PST equivalent that you need to know about. On that one. But keep in mind also that registration has a pro and a con to it. The con obviously is regulation. And it might, it marginally increases the cost of your services. But the pro of it is you then get to also write off your HST that you pay out in the course of your practice. And if you're buying supplements, at wholesale and then retailing them, for example, as part of your practice, you're paying HST when you buy that supplement, potentially. And you want to be able to write that off against the HST you collect, because HST is two sides, right? You write off what you pay, and and the net amount is what you actually remit to the government. So just because you don't have to charge it if you make under $30,000 federally, doesn't mean that you may not want to. It could still be a benefit to you. You just have the inconvenience of having to do so. But if you're not paying out any HST, it's not part of what you do, because all you're doing is providing health consulting, and it's $25,000 a year. In fees, and you're in a province of Ontario which has HST, absolutely correct. You do not have to charge HST, but you don't get to write it off either.
Great. I think that has covered most of the questions. Okay. and we're about out of practice, out of province, and we talked about that. So thank you. That's been amazing. I think you covered a ton of ground in a very short time. There's such a huge topic to talk about. If you haven't referenced the legal guide, it's available on Amazon. So you can get it very quickly, but it's a great reference because it does go province by province. And so many of the questions are province specific. It's a great reference to have. So thank you very much, Glenn. We appreciate your time.
Welcome.
And thank everyone for joining us.
Can I just say
my pleasure. It's a good group. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you for your questions.
Thanks. That was great. The questions.